It's a foggy night on old Cape Cod. A perfect night for a mystery. Tonight, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater presents an original mystery thriller entitled A Test for Murder. A slight problem is about to arise in Provincetown. The judge of an art show is going to be murdered on opening night. Captain Waverly Underhill, confronted with a freshly murdered corpse and a room full of suspects, is about to demonstrate his own rather unorthodox methods of conducting a murder investigation.
Expose him? But how? There are 70 or 80 people down there. How do you propose to find a killer out of so many suspects?
I'll ask them.
And you expect the killer to simply admit that he did it?
Yes, Doctor. That is precisely what I expect him to do.
Join us now as Captain Underhill administers a special kind of test, a pop quiz designed to pinpoint a cold-blooded killer out of a room full of artists, art lovers, and patrons of the arts who are all about to discover that their innocent evening of art is suddenly transformed into a test for murder.
I can understand why you've come to me. You want to hear my version of what happened. I don't mind retelling it. I suppose, in a way, I'm in a better position than anyone else to describe what happened that night, although there are certainly others who could give an accurate accounting. That was part of the problem, you see, the fact that there were so many of us there. I know you're mainly interested in hearing about the incident. Funny referring to murder as an incident, as though it were an innocuous, commonplace event. There's nothing innocuous or commonplace about it, I can assure you. When it happens, it's always a gruesome thing. Gruesome and quite shocking. Especially when it happens so unexpectedly. Of course, that's generally the case, isn't it? No one really expects a murder. Except the killer himself, I suppose. Even so, I think you'll agree, this one was more shocking and gruesome and unexpected than most of those you read about in the newspaper. My entire perspective in this matter is strongly colored by my close association with Captain Waverly Underhill. He's my friend and also, technically, one of my patients, although hardly a model patient, I can assure you. If most patients followed medical advice the way he does, then most doctors might just as well dispense with giving it. Captain Underhill is tall and thin, but certainly not underweight for a man in his middle 70s. It betrays no medical confidence to say that he sometimes suffers from heart palpitations, but more often complains of creeping senility, which he's convinced is robbing him of his mental faculties. Now, this is ridiculous, I assure you. Underhill's powers of reasoning are as sharp as ever. It's my professional opinion that this so-called senility, if it does exist, exists only in his mind. It didn't come out like I meant it to, but you know what I mean. Anyway, if you don't believe me, you have only to observe his actions in the incident I'm about to relate. The way he handled the case from beginning to end was pure Underhill. And if I say so myself, nothing less than a perfect demonstration of the investigator's art. It was a pleasantly cool evening, as I recall. Provincetown was just returning to normal after another summer of sensory overload. A fog bank was building out over the ocean, but the sky overhead was clear and full of stars. I can't really explain why I was there, or what it was at the last minute that made me decide to go. Attending the opening of art exhibits is not the sort of thing I do very often. I'd read the article that appeared in the Cape Cod Times. It sounded interesting, and I decided I should go, if for no other reason than to extricate myself from the rut I was in. As you know, the Alice B. Steiner Memorial Art Museum is located on the east end of Commercial Street in what was formerly a church. When I arrived, the opening was already well attended. I went in and spent the first 15 minutes looking at the paintings in one of the galleries. I certainly had no idea that I would encounter Captain Underhill there, although thinking about it now, I shouldn't have been surprised, since painting is one of his primary hobbies. Strangely enough, he didn't seem a bit surprised to see me.
Hello, Schofield. I was looking forward to bumping into you tonight.
Waverly, hello. I didn't expect to see you here. But wait a minute. How could you know?
Know what?
That I was coming. You couldn't have known. I only decided myself at the last minute. Honestly, Waverly, you may be an old cop, but you're becoming more like the legendary Sherlock Holmes every time we meet.
And you, Schofield, are becoming more and more like Dr. Watson. There are some interesting paintings here, I think. Why don't we have a look around?
Wait a minute. You still haven't explained how you knew.
Knew what?
That I was coming.
Oh, yes. You're still confused about that, aren't you? Well, actually, it's quite simple. First of all, I noticed the frayed cuff on the left sleeve of your sports jacket.
My cuff?
Also, there is a slight nick under your chin where you cut yourself shaving this morning. And if you'll notice, there are distinctive scuff marks on the toes of your shoes.
Good Lord, you mean from all that you were able to...
deduce that you were coming? Precisely. Of course, there's also the fact that since I arrived after you did, I noticed your signature on the guest register as I came in.
Oh. No, yes, I forgot I signed in. Well, so you're not so smart after all.
No, Doctor. And neither am I much of a practitioner of the Sherlock Holmes method of solving mysteries. Now, what do you say you take me around and show me what you've seen? But first, you need some champagne, and I need a refill.
Well, how much have you had already?
Oh, don't be such a physician. I'm well within my limit. Besides, at functions like these, champagne is absolutely essential. It sharpens the eye and heightens one's aesthetic sensibilities. Why, without it, a masterpiece might go totally unrecognized.
Excuse me, are you Mr. LaRoche?
No. No, I'm not.
Oh, darn rats. Now I'm getting nervous.
Is Mr. LaRoche someone important?
Well, yes, he is. He's judging the show. You haven't heard of him?
I'm afraid not.
Louis LaRoche is a famous art critic. He arrived today from New York. I'm on the welcoming committee, so I'm supposed to be looking after him. The only thing is, I don't even know who he is. Celia Hanselfer picked him up at the airport. So far, she's the only one who's met him, and I can't seem to find her either.
I notice ribbons hanging alongside some of the paintings. It appears the judging has already been completed.
Yes, it was this afternoon. But Mr. LaRoche was supposed to return tonight to make the presentations. That's going to be my fault if he doesn't show up. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have introduced myself. I'm Trudy Landsberger.
Waverly Underhill. And this is my friend, Alexander Schofield. He's a physician. His motto is, just because you're feeling fine is no reason to think you're not sick.
Waverly, please. Miss Landsberger, how do you do?
Fine, thank you. If you'll both excuse me now, I'd better keep searching for Mr. LaRoche.
If we see him, we'll let him know you're looking for him.
Please do. That'll be great.
Waverly, I can certainly do without introductions like that. Obviously, you're not to be trusted in social situations.
Oh, never mind that. Take a look at this painting. What do you make of it?
It's a nude portrait of a woman, isn't it?
Yes. Horrible, isn't it? I thought cubism had gone out of fashion years ago. Though it does sort of remind me of a song of my youth. Let's see. There once was a woman named Hannah. She lived in the desert all her life. Her breasts were like mesas, her hips an oasis. Oh, let me be in Hannah's Savannah tonight.
Oh, Waverly, try to be dignified.
Excuse me. How do you like it?
I'm sorry?
The painting. Do you like it?
Oh, well, actually, my friend and I were just discussing it. Are you the artist?
No, the subject. That's me. Can't you tell?
Oh, yes. Now that you mention it, I do see a resemblance.
You're Louis LaRoche, aren't you?
No, but it appears I could be.
You're an artist, then?
Not really.
Oh, yes, he is.
Just a hobbyist.
Don't let him fool you. He's quite good.
In that case, let me give you my card. My name is Beverly Sampson. I'm a professional model. I do private sittings. My rates are reasonable. I do classical poses as well as avant-garde.
I see. Well, Miss Sampson, I'll certainly hold on to your card. If I should ever...
Please do. You know, I especially enjoy working with older men.
Well, Waverly, it appears you've found someone who shares your interest in art. I suppose now you'll be giving up landscapes.
Oh, very funny, Doctor. You're just jealous because she didn't ask you.
You know, with a woman like that, you can't be too careful. If I were you, I'd definitely remain on my avant-garde.
I must admit, Alex, sometimes I do get the urge to...
Oh, my God!
Where did that come from?
Oh, help!
Up those stairs. Come on, Alex, quickly. You may be needed. What's wrong?
Over there.
I see him. Everyone, please, don't crowd up the stairs. Go on back down.
You need a doctor.
We have a doctor. Please, everyone, go back, please. We need your cooperation. Alex, you'd better examine him. If he's as dead as he looks, don't move him any more than you have to. Miss Lamsberger, please try to compose yourself. It's important that you tell us what happened.
I don't know. I was looking for Mr. LaRoche. I thought I might find him up here.
It's no use, Waverly. He's dead.
Do you think it's him?
Shall I check his wallet?
No, we'll wait for the police.
What in heaven's name is going on here? What in heaven's name is happening?
Please, we are asking everyone to wait downstairs.
Oh, truly, is that you?
It's all right, Mr. O'Neill. It's Mrs. Hampshire. Let her come up.
Oh, Trudy, what's going on? Oh, my dear God.
You recognize him?
Oh, yes, of course. It's Mr. LaRoche. Oh, is he...
Yes, he's been murdered. Mrs. Hanshofer, can you tell me who is in charge of the show?
I suppose I am. I'm chairperson for the Arts Council.
Excellent. Would you mind waiting just a minute? I'll need to ask you some questions. Alex, I need a favor done quickly.
What is it?
Go down and speak to the guard at the door. Tell him what's happened. Say there's been a murder, but don't give out any more details than you have to. Instruct him that he must make certain no one leaves until the police arrive. If anyone insists on going, get word to me. I'll speak to them personally. Any guests arriving late, turn them away and say there's been an accident. After that, call the Provincetown police and ask to speak to Walter Lafarge. Tell him there's been a homicide. He'll know what to do. Then, before you come back up, go out to your car and bring in your doctor's bag.
Waverly, don't you think it would be best for Miss Lamsberger to wait downstairs? She's obviously very distraught.
No, not yet. Not until I ask her a few questions.
Excuse me, but may I please ask who you are?
My name is Waverly Underhill. I'm a retired police captain, and this is Dr. Schofield. A serious crime has been committed here. With your permission, I intend to take charge of the situation until the police arrive. Alex, you'd better get going. Mrs. Hanshofer, I'd like to ask you a few questions while Miss Lamsberger takes a moment to compose herself.
Yes, of course.
Are you familiar with the building?
Oh, yes, I think so.
What is this room used for?
Storage and sometimes office space. Right now, as you see, most of the museum's permanent collection has been moved up here to make way for the exhibit down below.
There are no windows?
There were windows originally, but they were bricked over to create more wall space.
No hidden closets or cubby holes. No place that someone might hide.
No, I don't believe so. Well, you can see for yourself. It's just one large room.
That door at the back, does it lead to a fire escape?
It does.
Is it wired to an alarm system?
Yes. There is an audible alarm that sounds if the door is opened. It was necessary, of course, for insurance purposes and to protect the museum's property.
I see. If I test it now, can you shut it off?
Downstairs I can, in the office.
All right. Now, what about the restrooms? Where are they located?
The restrooms? Oh, downstairs.
All right, Mrs. Hanshofer. Here is what I'd like you to do. I'm going to wait up here while you go downstairs. Then I'm going to open that door. As soon as you hear the alarm, you can shut it off. Will you do that?
Yes, of course.
And then I want you to go and lock both bathrooms. Put out of order signs on them if you have to, but don't let anyone in. That's very important.
Yes, but what if someone has to...
Oh, they'll just have to wait, that's all. Tell them there's nothing you can do about it. Will you go and do that?
Yes, of course. All right, if you say so.
Thank you. Miss Lamsberger, how do you feel?
I feel all right.
Would you like me to ask Dr. Schofield to give you something to calm you down?
No, I don't think so. It's just that I feel so horrible about what happened. If I'd been with him like I was supposed to be, this whole thing wouldn't have happened.
Now, don't blame yourself. I'm going over now and try that door. You're probably going to hear a loud bell, so don't let it startle you.
Waverly, what's the matter? What's going on?
Oh, nothing, Doctor.
I was just testing the alarm system.
Oh, what for?
To establish the fact that the only way the killer could have come up here and gone down is by the stairs you just used. Miss Landsberger, do you feel up to answering a few questions?
Yes, I'll try.
Good. Can you tell me exactly what you saw when you came up here?
I didn't see anything. Not at first. There's not much light, is there? After I spoke with you and Dr. Schofield, I came up here thinking Mr. LaRoche might have come up to look over the museum's permanent collection.
When you came up, did you see anyone?
No.
Did you encounter anyone on the stairs?
No. No one. I thought I was completely alone. I was about to go back down. Then I saw him lying there. I thought he must be sick, that maybe he fainted. Then I saw the knife, and that's when I screamed.
All right. All right, Miss Landsberger. Thank you. I'd like you to go back downstairs now and try to relax. Have a glass of champagne. If anyone asks about what happened, tell them you've been instructed to say nothing until the police arrive. Will you do that?
Yes, I will.
Miss Landsberger, are you sure you're feeling well enough?
Yes, I am. Just a little shaky.
Well, if you need me for anything, please.
Yes. Thank you, Doctor. I'll be all right.
Well, Alex, what did you find out?
I spoke with the guard. He's making certain no one leaves. I called the Provincetown police. I couldn't get hold of Walter LaFarge, but someone else is on his way over.
All right. Open up your bag and let me have that contraption you used to peer inside a patient's ears.
Are you planning on examining his ears?
No. No, but I'm going to use the built-in light and magnifying glass to examine the handle of the knife.
For fingerprints?
Yes, though I don't expect to find any. Stay back if you don't mind. No point in both of us tramping around too close to the body. The nice thing about a knifing is it tells you a great deal more about the assailant than you can get from a gunshot wound. In this case, the murderer was obviously taller than his victim. The knife blade entered to the right of the spine, which suggests that the killer is right-handed. He used his left hand to cover the mouth to prevent a scream while he drove the knife upwards and in with his right hand. No fingerprints, as I expected.
Do you think the killer used gloves?
I doubt it. It's interesting that the weapon that was used is a dagger. Perhaps the killer was aware that the blade of a penknife can easily fold up if you try to insert it through thick clothing and into the body of a human being. The handle is cast from brass. That could be useful. Who is it? Police, come up. We've been expecting you. Are you the one who called? My name is Waverly Underhill. I'm a retired police captain. This is Dr. Schofield. He's the one who telephoned.
Boy, he's really dead, isn't he?
Yes. Yes, and freshly murdered, I might add. Where is Walter LaFarge?
In Boston, for a meeting. He's not coming back until tomorrow.
That means you're in charge?
Sort of. My name is Greenwood. Ray Greenwood. I'm only temporary. I was hired just for the summer.
Did you call Hyannis?
I called them. They're sending a squad car.
That gives us about 45 minutes.
I just realized, this is the first time in my life I've ever seen a dead body.
Officer Greenwood, if you don't mind, I've had quite a lot of experience in these matters. With your permission, I'm going to proceed with my own inquiry until the detectives from Hyannis arrive.
Yeah, sure. Fine by me. Like you say, you've obviously got a lot more experience.
Good. Now, here is what I'd like you to do. Go downstairs and assemble everyone into one room and arrange them all in a circle. See if you can find enough chairs for everyone to sit down. Next, make sure everyone gets a piece of paper and a pencil. Something they can use to write down the answers to a few questions. Last of all, see that everyone wears a name tag. If they demand to know what is going on, tell them detectives are on their way. And to save time, we're going to begin by conducting a preliminary inquiry. When you've done all that, I'll come down and take over. Is that all right?
Hey, I'm not sure I can okay all this.
Mr. Greenwood, you've just seen your first dead body. If we move quickly, you may yet get to meet your first murderer.
Clearly, you can't be thinking the killer is still down there.
Oh, yes. I'm fairly certain of it.
But why would he?
Why? Because leaving would only serve to call attention to himself. Right now, that's the last thing in the world he wants to do.
You said he. Are you convinced it's a man?
More than likely. Most knife killings are done by men. Women prefer guns. Yes, I believe he's still here. And I intend to use this opportunity to expose him.
Expose him? But how? There are 70 or 80 people down there. How do you propose to find a killer out of so many suspects?
I'll ask them.
And you expect the killer to simply admit that he did it?
Yes, Doctor. That is precisely what I expect him to do. Could I have your attention, please? Quiet, please. Thank you. First of all, let me introduce myself. My name is Waverly Underhill. I'm a police captain, now retired. As I'm certain you are all aware, a man has been murdered upstairs. Officer Greenwood of the Provincetown Police has already notified Hyannis, and they are sending up a team of investigators. They should be arriving within the hour. In the meantime, since all of you will be questioned, and since I've been through this procedure many times before, I suggested to Officer Greenwood that he allow me to begin with a few preliminary questions, which should help speed things up once the detectives arrive. If everyone is agreed, and if there are no questions, I'll begin
it's
by...
Louis LaRoche, who was murdered, isn't it?
That's right, Mr. I can't quite see your name tag. Mr. Hirsch. Mr. LaRoche arrived just today from New York. He was here to judge the show.
Now, isn't that fitting? The famous art critic gets bumped off at an opening. If you ask me, whoever did it should win first prize. It's unquestionably the best example of performance art I've ever seen.
How vulgar. That's one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard.
Disgusting? Why so disgusting? Everyone who knows anything about the art world knows what a creep Louis LaRoche was. How he delighted in destroying people's careers.
Jason, why don't you shut up? The man's dead. He's not going to hurt you anymore.
Oh, he may be dead, but that doesn't mean I'm obligated to honor his memory. I'd like to know who did it. I'd like to shake his hand.
Let me suggest that if there are opinions about Mr. LaRoche, you all save them for when the detectives arrive. Right now, I'd like to get started.
Mr. Underhill, Mr. Underhill, since you're going to be asking us questions, I would like to ask you one, if you don't mind. Is it your opinion that the murderer is one of us in this room? If so, I think we should be made aware of it, since this person is obviously dangerous.
Since you brought it up, Mr. Kiefer, I will say quite candidly that it is probable the murderer is one of us. However, as to the possibility of him striking again, that is remote. First of all, he's almost certainly unarmed, having left his knife upstairs in the back of his victim. Secondly, it's not likely he will try anything rash unless he feels he is being cornered. As you will see by the general nature of the questions I intend to ask, that is not going to happen.
Oh, let's all stop being alarmists. This sounds like perfect fun to me. Just like a parlor game. Personally, I hope we nail the bastard.
Well, thank you, Mrs.
Florence Rigby. Mrs. Florence Rigby.
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Rigby. All right. Now, to begin, I'd like you to write your name in the upper left-hand corner. Now, put your address underneath that. And please include your permanent address if you are only visiting Cape Cod.
Which one's our permanent address?
And next, list your occupation.
Do I have an occupation?
After that, I'd like to know if you came alone tonight or with someone else. If you came with others, please list their names. No conferring on this, please. Simply answer the questions as best you can.
It's been so long since I've taken a test, I feel like I'm back in school.
Well,
Don't think of it as a test. Think of it as a questionnaire. All right. Next, I'd like to know if at any time tonight you used the restroom. No need to elaborate. Just answer yes or no. I would also like to know if at any time this evening you saw anyone else go into the restroom. And if so, please list their names, using the name tags if necessary. Finally, I'd like you to state if at any time tonight you went upstairs. Now, this is not intended to incriminate you. You may have had a perfectly innocent reason. But since the police will want to know sooner or later, let's indicate it here. Oh, yes, one last thing. Also, list the names of anyone you saw going upstairs or coming down. Again, refer to the name tags if you have to. And that's all. Dr. Schofield will collect your papers. I suggest until the police arrive, you relax and try to enjoy the show. And thank you all for your cooperation.
Here are the papers, Waverly. If you don't mind my saying so, I don't see what good they're going to do you. You didn't even ask what time they arrived or where they were when the murder took place. Now, if it had been me, those would have been the first two questions I would have asked.
In answer to your first question, if we need to know what time people arrived, we can easily determine that according to their relative position on the guest register. As to where each person was when the murder occurred, how can we ask that? All we know is the approximate time Miss Landsberger discovered the body. The actual murder may have taken place anywhere from 5 minutes to as much as 35 minutes before she arrived.
Well, what good does it do to ask if they went to the bathroom?
Here it is. This is what I was looking for. What we're trying to find, Alex, is the intersection of two distinct sets. Number one, the set of all people who admit coming up here tonight. And number two, the set of all those who admit using the restroom downstairs. I'm convinced the murderer did both.
Well, how can you be sure of that?
Well, it stands to reason, doesn't it? First of all, we assume the killer is someone who came here tonight with the intention of murdering Mr. LaRoche. Not many people carry around a dagger as part of their normal evening attire. Next, we have to ask ourselves, why did he do it up here? The reason, of course, is that he was watching LaRoche the entire evening, waiting for an opportunity. The murder of Louis LaRoche was definitely premeditated, but it was also spontaneous in the sense that the killer could not have known in advance that this sort of opportunity would present itself. He saw LaRoche climb the stairs coming up here. He followed him up, saw that they were alone, and then quickly murdered him. He did not use gloves because gloves would have taken too long to put on and take off. Instead, he wielded the knife barehanded, and then most likely used his handkerchief to wipe the handle free of prints. Now, put yourself in the mind of the killer. You've just murdered LaRoche. What would you do next? Remember, we've already established it would be foolish of him to leave. What is the most logical thing?
Go back down and mingle with the guests, I suppose.
Yes, but only after you had made a quick detour to the restroom. You'd need a chance to compose yourself, to check in the mirror, make certain there are no bloodstains, nothing to give yourself away. Ergo, the killer is someone who admits coming up here and also admits stopping in to use the bathroom.
But why admit to either one?
Because I also asked everyone to list the names of anyone they saw coming upstairs or using the bathroom. If the killer denies either one and someone else says they saw him do it, that sets up a discrepancy. And discrepancies are the basic underpinnings of all murder investigations, and exactly what the killer wishes to avoid at all costs. Therefore, he will innocently admit to both, and then when questioned by the police, he will simply claim there was no dead body here when he came up. Do you see?
Yes, I think so.
So, having said all that, I now present you with the murderer.
Alfred Turk, Jr.
You'll notice Mr. Turk admits using the restroom and also admits having come up here. He lists himself as an artist. Mr. Turk most likely murdered Mr. LaRoche because he felt LaRoche had snubbed him in some way. Artists are quite temperamental. They don't take criticism at all well. Also, the fact that his name ends in Junior may indicate a personality problem. You'd be surprised the number of sons who are forever juniors to their father's name that develop serious complexes as they get older.
It says here that he came with his wife.
Yes, but that doesn't matter. When he saw LaRose coming up here, he could have easily excused himself, saying he was going to use the men's room, and then taken a detour upstairs. In fact, if you notice on her answer sheet, she does list her husband as having gone to the restroom, yet she does not put him down for having come up here.
Then you've solved the case.
Only partially. So far, all we've done is identify the primary suspect. We still have to prove he did it, and prove it in a way that will satisfy a judge and jury. No jury is going to convict a man because he admits using the restroom, or even if he admits coming upstairs. Consider, we have no eyewitnesses, no hard evidence, such as fingerprints, no motive beyond conjecture, and the weapon that was left behind is almost certainly untraceable.
Then you're saying this is one of those cases where the actual murderer is known, but still he goes free?
Not necessarily. Not if we can salvage a little more time before the detectives arrive.
Captain Underhill's strategy was simple and direct. He planned to talk Alfred Turk into confessing. He pointed out to me that in situations where tangible evidence was slim or non-existent, a confession was often the only possible means of solving a case. He seemed fairly optimistic about his chances. Psychologically, he said, a man who was bold enough to risk murdering someone in such a public place would also have an overly inflated opinion of his own invincibility. An opinion that, once put under attack, might quickly break down into a desperate need to tell all. I suggested why not wait and let the police handle it. He told me that was exactly what he hoped to avoid. Confessions obtained by the police are scrutinized by the courts to make certain that they were done without coercion, intimidation, or trickery. On the other hand, Underhill, acting as a private citizen, could say or suggest anything he wanted. He'd not be subject to the same restraints. I was once again amazed at how difficult the detective's job had become. Not only must he think like a criminal to solve the case, but he must also think like a lawyer, judge, and jury to be sure that his efforts will not be wasted and the case thrown out of court. Captain Underhill gave me a quick list of instructions. First, to lend him the miniature tape recorder I carry in my doctor's bag, which I use to record notes on patients when I make house calls. Next, to go downstairs and invite Alfred Turk, or Mac the Knife, as Underhill was now taken to calling him, to join him upstairs. After that, I was to go outside with Officer Greenwood and wait for the detectives from Hyannis to arrive. We were to intercept them and instruct them to wait for a signal that Underhill would pass along by tapping three times on the floor. It was his feeling that timing and the manner in which the detectives arrived were essential to the success of his plan. When I suggested the investigators might be unwilling to postpone their arrival while he conducted an experiment, he told me to use his name and do the best I could. It was not until later, of course, when I listened to the recording Underhill made, that I learned what actually took place when Mr. Turk came upstairs.
Your doctor friend downstairs said you wanted to see me?
That's right. Have a seat.
My wife will be worried.
Oh, I'm sure your wife will understand.
Look, just because I admit I came up here, that doesn't mean I had anything to do with what happened.
I never said you did. Sit down.
I'm not going to sit up here in the same room with a dead body.
It bothers you?
Of course it bothers me. It would bother anybody who had any feelings. At least you could have the decency to cover him up.
Oh, no. Never do that. That's the worst thing you could do. Sit down.
All right. But just for a minute.
Good. Now, to explain why you should never cover a murder victim, Mr. Turk, it's because you don't want to contaminate the evidence. You see, when the killer chose to murder Mr. LaRoche by stabbing him in the back,
It meant he had to bring his own body into close contact with his victims.
So?
Well, undoubtedly he left behind all sorts of incriminating evidence. Strands of hair, loose threads from his clothing, even skin cells. Did you know the average body sheds approximately 40,000 skin cells every minute?
No, I didn't know that.
And you'll notice that Mr. LaRoche is wearing a tweed jacket. Tweed is like Velcro. It picks up every little thing it touches. So you see, covering the body with a sheet, like they do in the movies, would only contaminate the evidence that's already present.
So is that going to prove who did it?
Oh, not necessarily. Not by itself. But evidence in a murder case is always cumulative. You keep adding a little more and a little more, and pretty soon the scales of justice begin to tip from a presumption of innocence to an assumption of guilt. For example, you'd be surprised how much we already know about how the murder was committed. We know the killer came here tonight with the intention of murdering Mr. LaRoche. He watched, saw him climb the stairs, followed him up, and then took advantage of the fact they were alone to sneak behind him and slip a knife between his ribs. We know the killer is right-handed. We know approximately how tall he is. And we know he didn't use gloves. Instead, he used his handkerchief to wipe the handle free of prints. Unfortunately, that was a mistake, since the handle of the knife is cast out of brass. If the killer's palms were sweating, as undoubtedly they were, then the sweat from his hands will have corroded some of the metal, traces of which will show up on his handkerchief under laboratory analysis. And, oh, I hope I'm not boring you.
No. Go on.
Of course, it's all circumstantial, but as the saying goes, if you see footprints in the snow and letters in the mailbox, you can assume the mailman has been there. Now, juries know this. They're much more sophisticated these days, much more willing to consider related evidence. Lawyers know it, too. In fact, many of the ones I know say they actually prefer circumstantial evidence. Eyewitnesses can be mistaken. Often they get rattled when they have to stand up in a courtroom and testify about what they saw. But you take an expert in forensic science, someone who is accustomed to getting up in front of a jury, and then
Would you mind telling me what all this has to do with me?
I'm not saying it has anything to do with you.
Then I think I'd like to go back downstairs, thank you.
All right. All right. That's your privilege. There's just one point I'd like to make.
And what is that?
The investigation of this murder is not going to begin officially until a team of detectives arrives from Hyannis, which should be any minute. And right now, I think whoever did this had better be asking himself a few hard questions.
What kind of questions?
Like what will happen if he keeps quiet? Will there be enough evidence to bring an indictment? If I can learn this much in half an hour, imagine what a team of highly trained investigators will be able to uncover in a week. For example, where did the knife come from? Now, a knife may not be as traceable as a gun, but one as distinctive as this, I would think there may be a store on the Cape, perhaps one right here in Provincetown, with a sales clerk who will remember selling a knife like this to a particular customer. There's also the question of motive. Will the police be able to prove that the murderer knew his victim? Things like that.
I still don't understand why you're telling me all
Of course, if the murderer decides to take a chance and keep quiet, it's going to make it very difficult for his attorney. The charge will be first-degree murder, premeditated. The judge will take his place on the bench, rap the gavel three times, and then the attorney for the defense will have to stand up and try to prove that his client is completely innocent. On the other hand, if the murderer is waiting up here, ready to confess to the police as soon as they arrive, it will open up a whole range of avenues for his attorney. It may even get the charge reduced to second or third degree homicide. Unfortunately, the killer is going to have to make up his mind in a hurry before the police get here. You can hear them coming now, can't you? They're on their way. Once he makes his decision, he's going to have to stick to it. There will be no turning back. Not even if he wants to.
The rest of what happened you know from reading the newspapers. The homicide squad arrived in their cruisers from Hyannis and found upstairs not only the body of the murdered man, but also the confessed killer himself, Mr. Alfred Turk, Jr. A large contingency of reporters showed up soon afterward, representing newspapers, radio, and television. News footage that appeared the next day showed the police carrying the body out in a stretcher and then escorting the accused in handcuffs out of the building and into a waiting squad car. Typically enough, in the reports that followed, little or nothing was said of Captain Waverly Underhill's role in solving the case, although Officer Greenwood was cited for taking unspecified quick action that ensured the suspect did not escape. When the police and reporters finally cleared out, the opening actually resumed and continued until very late, with everyone in surprisingly good spirits. Nothing like a murder to enliven the mood. Captain Underhill strolled about, looking at the paintings and talking to others. I noticed him from time to time, ignoring my advice and still drinking champagne. Around 1:30, I decided it was time for me to leave. I looked around for Captain Underhill and found him sitting alone. I offered to drive him home. He declined, saying that was something that he had already taken care of. Before I could ask the question, I was given the answer. As I turned around to observe Miss Beverly Sampson approaching with a smile on her lips and carrying two glasses of champagne. My solitary ride home that night was filled with envious imaginings.
You have been listening to Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater's presentation of A Test for Murder. Tonight's program was produced, written, and directed by Stephen Honey. Co-produced by David Ellsworth. Engineered by John Todd. With original music composed by Mark Birmingham. Assisting in the production were Scott Dickey and Carol McManus. The actors in tonight's play, Dave Ellsworth, Captain Underhill. Wally O'Hara, Dr. Schofield. Neil McGarry played Alfred Turk, Jr. Eva Brodesson was Trudy Landsberger. Mary B. Jones, Celia Hanshofer. Lainey Davis, Beverly Sampson. Kevin Grappi, Officer Greenwood. Fred Morey, Mr. Kiefer. Bill Dane, Jason Hirsch. And Carol McManus played Florence Rigby. A Test for Murder was recorded at HT Recording Studio and is copyrighted by Stephen Olney for Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. All rights, including rights for broadcast and reproduction, are reserved. This program is made possible with the cooperation of the Public Media Foundation. This is Bob Nolan wishing you a pleasant evening and inviting you to tune in again when the fog rolls in on another chapter of Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater.